Okay, good morning, good vach, Shavua Tov. Thank you all for being here this morning. So we have the privilege of partnering with the OU to present this important community kashrus event. We're grateful to you for coming to learn more about kashrus. Often our OU partnership weekend, we emphasize that the OU is so much more than just kashrus. We talk about all the other areas the OU is involved with in enhancing Jewish life, not only in America, but throughout the world, in such meaningful ways. And while that remains very, very true, and we're so proud to be an OU shul, this morning we come back to the basics of the OU, and that is the incredible gift the OU provides the kosher observant community around the world in their supervision of kashrus. The OU is really the authority on kashrus, recognized and appreciated by kashrus organizations around the world for their expertise and for their resource, for their wisdom, and for their guidance. I know down here, we, the ORB, work very closely with the OU in turn on a regular basis for their expertise and for their wisdom in different areas that we're navigating. I don't know the statistics, I'm sure our wonderful guests can share them, of the tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands, millions of products that the OU supervises in countries across the world, and most exotic locations where the mashkichim have to travel. But really, it's an amazing thing that one can walk into a supermarket, certainly across the United States, but arguably across the world, and you'll find kosher products that bear the reliable symbol of the OU. The OU is the highest standard in kashrus, and we're so deeply grateful to our outstanding experts who are with us this morning for the amazing work that they do. First, we have the privilege of hearing from Rabbi Moshe Elefant. Rabbi Elefant is the COO and Executive Rabbinic Coordinator of OU Kosher. He has the distinction of having the most popular Daf Yomi listened to in the world. If you listen on the OU website, there are thousands of people listening to his Daf every single day. He's an outstanding Talmud Chacham, expert in the field of Kashrus. He'll be speaking about what could be wrong with, and he will fill in the many blanks following. After he speaks, we'll have the opportunity for questions and answers with Rabbi Elefant, and then we'll have the privilege of introducing and hearing Rabbi Yaakov Luban. So for now, please rise and join me in welcoming Rabbi Moshe Elefant.
Thank you, Rabbi Goldberg. Truly an honor to be able to speak in this community, which we hear so much about up north. What a wonderful, incredible work Rabbi Goldberg, his predecessors that we also know did in building such a Torah observant community. As an introduction to my comments today about what could be wrong, I recently had the opportunity to speak at the Aguda Convention, and at the Aguda Convention, I mentioned a story that I recently saw. There was a Maggid in Yerushalayim, a famous speaker in Yerushalayim. His name was Rav Shapsi Yudalovich. And Rav Shapsi Yudalovich was once flying on a plane from Israel to the United States. And sitting next to him was a gentleman. And they introduced each one to each other. And they asked each other what are their professions, and this gentleman tells Rav Shapsi Yudalovich that he's a zoologist. As they begin the meal service on the plane, Rav Yudalovich notices that this zoologist had not ordered a kosher meal. And he asked him, "Why didn't you order a kosher meal?" He was obviously Jewish. He says, "Although I believe in God, I believe there is a God, I don't believe in Torah min Hashamayim. I don't believe that Torah was given to us from Hashem. It's inconceivable to me," he said, "that Moshe Rabbeinu in the desert found the Torah, went up to Shamayim and received the Torah. It can't be. And therefore," he said, "I don't believe in Torah min Hashamayim, and therefore the halachas of kashrus, which are in the Torah, don't speak to me." So Rav Yudalovich asked this individual, "You told me you're a zoologist, and I have a question for you. You know, we all know that what are the signs of a kosher animal and what are the signs of a non-kosher animal. And kosher animal, we all know, is mafresis parsis v'sheisah shesa, split hooves and chews its cud. And the Torah HaKadosh says that there are four animals, there are only four animals that have only one of these signs. Gomo, Shafan, Vahneves, those four animals have chewed their cud but don't have split hooves. And the Chazir, the pig, we know has split hooves but doesn't chew its cud. He said, you told me you're a zoologist. In all of the years of your study, have you found any other animal that has those characteristics? Have you ever been able to find another animal besides those four that have only one of the two simonim? He thinks, and he says, no, I was never able to come up with such a situation. So he says, if Torah, isn't that a proof that Torah is min Hashamayim? If Moshe Rabbeinu in the Midbar, as you said, Moshe Rabbeinu in the desert, there were no animals there, was able to know that in the history of mankind there will be no other animals with only one simon besides these four animals, isn't that a proof that the Torah is indeed min Hashamayim? As I learned this story, as I read the story, I thought to myself, why from all of the mitzvahs of the Torah that Hashem choose to teach us the concept of Torah min Hashamayim? We're all Jews who are believers in Torah min Hashamayim. But why this fundamental of our religion, of Torah min Hashamayim, is specifically taught to us in the concept of Macholas Asuris? And I thought to myself of another story that I heard. There was once a situation where there was a couple who had a child, Baruch Hashem, a healthy, well child, was going to school, was doing well. And all of a sudden, not after a couple of years, he turned around. And he wasn't behaving properly, he wasn't acting properly, he wasn't studying properly. The parents were distraught. They went all over to different specialists, and nobody could identify what was wrong with this child. They went to Rabbi Akiva Eiger. The story happened in the town of Poznan on the German-Polish border, where Rabbi Akiva Eiger was the Rav. And they asked him, maybe he could help them understand what happened here. And Rabbi Akiva Eiger asked them, do you feed your child only kosher food? And they look at him, of course, we run a perfectly kosher home. He said, are you sure? And they began to think. And they remembered that there was an individual in the town, this could happen, that was a butcher. He was a butcher in the city, and his hashgacha was removed because he didn't deserve to have hashgacha. But he still wanted to continue selling meat. So he put up on the sign on his butcher shop that I'm kosher. He doesn't have a rav, he doesn't have a hashgacha certifying him. I'm kosher because I say I'm kosher. But that was not with a proper hechsher. And how was he able to attract consumers to come to his store? He was able to sell the product cheaper. And they bought food from that, they bought meat from that butcher. After they bought meat from that butcher, he said, you can't have a question why your child is not succeeding. The Torah, our Torah is Torah min Hashamayim. And the diet that Hashem wants us to eat is the diet of kosher food. That's where HaKadosh Baruch Hu shows that Torah is min Hashamayim. And therefore, if you're not going to be careful about kosher, you're going to have serious issues. So I was asked to speak in today's session, what could be wrong? Actually, we get paid to say what could be right. We get paid to give hashgachas. Our mission is indeed to certify products around the country and around the world. Rabbi Goldberg asked that we mention the statistics. The statistics of the OU are that we certify plants in 90 countries around the world and in every one of the 50 states of the United States. We certify 8,000 facilities in those countries. We would probably certify products in more plants and countries, but our first obligation is to the safety of our mashgichim. So obviously that, unfortunately, in the world that we live in, excludes many countries that we won't send our mashgichim into danger. We certify close to 1 million products. Before I go further, I have to acknowledge an individual who's sitting here who really is the unsung hero, in my mind, of OU Kosher, and that's Mr. Julius Berman, who was the chairman of OU Kosher for many years. In fact, I still remember, this goes back over 28 years ago, Hashanah Rabbah 28 years ago, when I visited him the first time for an interview to be employed by the OU. And even though he is not actively involved in the Kashrus Commission currently, he still, besides being a Chosh V'Talmud Chacham and a friend, is a person that we turn to for advice as recently as last week. So one of the most common questions that we're asked, and I made sure that's a question that's relevant to people down here in Florida because I saw there's one right next to the shul here, are the question of Starbucks. Everybody wants to know, may I buy a coffee in Starbucks? And there are many questions that come up when we speak about Starbucks. There are actually two types of Starbucks. There's a Starbucks that only sells coffee. Those are called kiosks. Those types of Starbucks you'll typically find in an airport, you'll typically find in a mall, and there the question of buying a coffee is much less of a question. Really, all of the coffee that they're using are certified. Actually, all Starbucks bag coffees, you could buy a bag of Starbucks coffee in the supermarket, all of those Starbucks coffees are OU certified, and those are the coffees that are used in their store. Moreover, Starbucks, the actual coffee that they use, even though that they write that they have in different varieties, all of them are really just different types of coffee beans. And one of the most commonly asked questions, a question I was just asked by my wife last night, is does coffee without flavor need supervision? And the answer is coffee without any flavors do not need any supervision. And therefore, the plain Starbucks coffee don't need supervision. Furthermore, we have investigated and discovered that you can request, when you come to a Starbucks, that they sprinkle into your coffee some flavor. All the flavors that are being used by Starbucks are OSHA kosher certified. So that's the good news. So when you go to a regular Starbucks, you could buy coffee without any issue if it's a Starbucks kiosk, usually. What do I mean when I say the word usually? So let's speak about the other type of Starbucks. The other types of Starbucks is where they don't just sell coffee, is where they sell sandwiches and pastries and other products as well. In those Starbucks, the coffee is fine, but that's not the issue that we need to discuss. The issue we need to discuss is the dishwasher and the other utensils that they're using, not just for kosher coffee, but for the other products. So I know there may be Talmidei Chachamim in the audience that may suggest, well, everything that's washed in the dishwasher, before they begin the dishwasher, they put soap into the dishwasher, and that will cause that everything that's in the dishwasher is foul tasting. I just would ask Rabbi Goldberg a question. How many times do Rabbanim get a question where somebody accidentally found a dairy spoon in their meat dishwasher, or vice versa? I know when we get these kind of questions, people are ready to throw out their dishwasher, they're ready to throw out their silverware, they're ready to kasher their whole house, where there's a lot of, there's good reason for one to be lenient. Here, on a regular basis, they're using the same dishwasher for kosher and non-kosher. So how could you use and eat food from such an establishment? And therefore, we don't recommend that people purchase coffee from Starbucks that sell non-kosher food. Furthermore, even the Starbucks kiosks that I said are really just selling coffee, we know that real estate in a shopping mall or real estate in an airport is very expensive. And what may happen is, although they have their own stand where they're selling their own product, next, they don't have their own dishwasher. They may be sharing a dishwasher with an establishment right next door, which is a truly non-kosher establishment. So if you want to buy coffee in a Starbucks kiosk, you really ought to make sure that they have their own, not only is it a freestanding enterprise, but they don't share equipment that could be used for non-kosher. On the subject of coffee, one more very commonly asked question is, everyone has Keurig machines, and there are many questions that come up with Keurig machines. The first question that comes up with Keurig machine is, if I buy a Keurig machine, do I have to tevel it? Do I have to take it to the mikveh? So the answer is, don't take it to the mikveh, because if you're going to take it to the mikveh, you might as well leave it in the mikveh, because it's not going to survive the mikveh. However, the good news is that most Paiskim are of the opinion, the OU Paiskim, Rabbi Belsky, Rabbi Schechter, all of the opinion that a Keurig machine does not need tefillah. Why? Number one, the Keurig machine is almost entirely plastic. There's only two metal pins in the entire Keurig machine. So that's one reason. We know that plastic doesn't need tefillah. Furthermore, those metal pins, and unless you're very handy, don't try to take them out because you probably won't figure out how to put it back in. Those metal pins are inside the vessel, and most Paiskim are of the opinion if it's not noticeably metal, then you don't have to tevel it. Furthermore, there are Paiskim, I myself heard this from Rav Shlomo Zalman Braun, that if you could only use a vessel when it's connected, when it's plugged in, it's considered mechubal kak, it's considered connected to the ground. And anything that's connected to the ground does not need tefillas kelim. So you don't have to tevel it. But when we speak about the Keurig machine, when we speak about Keurig, there are other issues. Firstly, one of the most commonly asked questions, somebody just asked me this question yesterday in shul, is that in many hotels there are Keurig machines, and if somebody is coming and staying in a hotel that's obviously a non-kosher hotel, what could he do in terms of kashering the Keurig machine? So what would be best is that if you knew that the machine wasn't used for 24 hours. If you knew that the machine wasn't used for 24 hours, then you could be comfortable that, because whenever we kasher, we want to have 24 hours downtime. If you don't have that, as long as it's perfectly clean, and you run a cycle, and what you need to do to run a cycle is you need to take a K-cup, you need to take one of these cups of coffee, put it into the machine, let the entire cycle go through, not drink that particular cup of coffee, and then you're good to go. However, there are a number of other important issues to mention when we speak about the K-cups. Firstly, not all K-cups are kosher. Not only are not all K-cups kosher, some of them are dairy. So if you're careful about Chol Yisrael, they're not Chol Yisrael. Or if you want to drink a coffee or a tea, and you're fleishig, you just ate meat, obviously you shouldn't be using those K-cups. So there's a number of questions that come up. The first question that comes up is if someone, and this comes up in offices very often, there are offices that have these Keurig machines, and not everybody has the good fortune, as we do, to work in an office where there are only religious Jews. And you need to know that all the K-cups that are being used are kosher. However, our Paiskim have told us that even if a K-cup that wasn't certified or was dairy was used, and there was a cup that the coffee dripped into, there is no problem of the aroma going up. There is an issue, however, of kashering it, and the method of kashering is the method that I just described. There's another very important issue which is fairly current when we speak about K-cups. The company that manufactures these products is a company in Vermont. The name of the company is Green Mountain Coffee. Green Mountain Coffee, for many years, as they developed this product, had the OU or OUD or no OU on each particular cup. A number of months ago, they requested that they don't want to do that anymore. The cups come in a carton, and they only want to put the kosher symbol on the outside carton. They don't want to put the kosher symbol on each particular cup. They were very cooperative. They said if there's going to be a variety that has in it a non-kosher type, or there's going to be a variety that has in it a dairy type, they'll either label it all OUD or won't label it an OU at all. But if they have a variety, or it's all one type, they're all kosher and all parv, they just want to put the OU on the outside carton, not on each particular cup. And what I want to say now is not just about K-cups. It's something that I like to speak about when I speak to different audiences about kashrus. You know, many people are under the impression that the people who have the real authority in matters of kashrus and people who really can make a difference are the Rabbanim HaMakshirim, are the Rabbanim who give Hashgachas. Hopefully, we do have some level of ability. But ladies and gentlemen, the level of ability that you have is a lot greater than ours. I always repeat the story that I myself was part of. For many, many years, Mars, the big chocolate company, refused to be kosher certified. There are many theories as to why, unimportant. But they never wanted to be kosher certified. Finally, they became kosher certified on the M&Ms, not because they wanted to be kosher certified. They still had not changed their mind yet. What happened was, there are many ice creams that the OU certifies. And the ice creams have M&M pieces in the ice cream. And these ice cream manufacturers were telling the Mars company, well, we're kosher certified, we're OU certified, and we need those M&Ms to be certified because everything we manufacture, we want to be kosher. So they became certified just for the M&Ms. Not long afterwards, a number of weeks afterwards, they requested to have a meeting with us. This goes back many years. We've already moved twice since then. And they came to our office and they said, Rabbis, we want everything certified. Everything that could be kosher, we want should be kosher. And I was younger, I'm a New Yorker, so I had the chutzpah to ask them, you know, for decades, you didn't want to have anything to do with the OU. And now, in a couple of weeks, you just can't get enough of us? So they said to us, Rabbis, you know, on the back of every package we sell, there's an 800 number for consumer calls. And those calls are very important to us. And after M&M's became kosher certified, we got many calls that we monitored. And I'll never forget the words they used. They said those calls were passionate. People were passionate about the fact that we had become OU certified and were anxious to see more products OU certified. And we want to satisfy our customers. So if our customers want the product kosher, we're here to ask to supervision on as many products as we could have certified. So what I say to you is, yes, we have scheduled, it's been already canceled because we don't have the same kind of winter as you do here. So we were supposed to go to Vermont, to the headquarters of Green Mountain, to have a discussion about this. But getting from New York to Vermont this winter has been somewhat complicated, so we're going to have to wait toward the spring. But if consumers will tell Green Mountain, we want to see the OU on the cup, not just on the outside carton. The carton is open. We don't know what goes in. We don't know what goes out. It would have a lot more of an effect. Another issue that I would like to speak about, and it's very much connected to what I just mentioned, and that is the area of consumer responsibility. A number of months ago, I had the opportunity to be at a conference. There's an organization called ACCO. ACCO stands for Association of Kashrus Organizations. And a number of months ago, I had the opportunity to be at, they had a conference of the various hashgachas. Your local hashgachas were also there. And there was a fascinating presentation. There was a young man from Toronto. The local supervision in Toronto is called COR, who did a lot of research about all types of locks. All types of locks, and which locks are foolproof, cannot be broken into, and which locks are easy to break into. Probably what he did was somewhat illegal, but he showed us in a presentation that every type of lock that he had purchased, cheap, expensive, sophisticated, all types of locks, could be easily broken. And therefore, since the basis of many hashgachas, particularly in the supervision of food service, caterers, restaurants, is that the mashgiach locks up the kitchen, and here he's telling us it may be useless because all of these locks could be broken and then closed and no one will ever know the difference. And I have to tell you that that presentation had a very profound effect on the audience. Obviously, people were, we're all rabbonim who are in the field of kashrus. All of us so much rely on these locks, and now we see that what can we do? And everybody got up with a comment and with a question and with a suggestion. And then came my turn to make a comment. I said a very simple comment, I think was a simple comment. I said, you know why this is a problem? Because the person you're giving supervision to, you don't really trust. And because you really don't trust the person, you need to lock up the kitchen. The person you're giving hashgacha to may not even be observant, may not be Jewish, may not be trustworthy, and therefore you need to lock up the kitchen. But if you were giving hashgacha to someone who's trustworthy, who's a person that you would eat in his home, and would never be, and is a person that would never serve other people something that's not kosher, you wouldn't have this problem. So the question really isn't the lock. The question is, who are we giving hashgacha to? So after I made my comment, people came over to me and they said, you don't understand, because you're from New York, and in New York there's plenty available, and in New York you could be choosy who you could give hashgacha to and who not. I said, you're right, certainly we have much more of a base in New York, and therefore we have more opportunity to make these kind of standards. But again, kashrus is a consumer-driven industry. And if a consumer will ask, who is the caterer? About 2 years ago, fascinating, about 2 years ago, many of you might have heard there was a terrible, terrible incident in California where there was a butcher shop that was caught, and of course this always happens Erev Pesach. My wife doesn't rely on me to help too much anyway, but Erev Pesach, she knows for sure I won't be available, because Erev Pesach, there's always going to be a crisis. So the crisis that year was that this butcher shop in Los Angeles was caught we're still not sure till this very day how bad the situation was. It was certainly bad. Was it kosher meat, not glatt? Was it chas v'shalom, not treif meat? I don't know. But the issue clearly was that this individual who owned that supermarket, that butcher shop, had been already caught previously doing something wrong. So how should such an individual get a hashgacha again? How could a consumer walk in to that store? You know, we believe that everything's min hashamayim. So just yesterday, I was reading about Rabbi Yisrael Salanter. Rabbi Yisrael Salanter's yard site is this Shabbos, this coming Shabbos. And Rabbi Yisrael Salanter once came to a village, and obviously he looked like a rov, and a person sees him and runs over to him and says to him, "Wonderful, I see you. I have in my backyard some chickens and some ducks and some geese that I need slaughtered. I need geschachten. And you look like a person that knows how to shecht a chicken." So he says to him, "Fine." He says, "Before I go to slaughter them, can you do me a favor? Can you lend me $10,000? He says, "Lend you $10,000? I don't even know you." He says, "Oh, so to lend me money you won't, because you don't know me. But for hashgacha that I could shecht, that's okay." That's the point I'm trying to make here. We need to know who are we eating from. The fact that there's a kosher symbol, it's great. But the consumer should be demanding from the hashgachas, that's not just enough that there's a symbol. Who's the person that we're giving hashgacha to? And we need to demand. And if you will demand, that will be responded to. We need to demand higher levels of kashrus. That not to give hashgacha to someone who needs the lock. Because the person who needs the lock will also know how to break the lock. On the same vein, at that same conference, and this is very much along the same issue, someone mentioned a story that happened here in Florida. I don't imagine that most individuals are aware of the story, so I'll repeat it, because it's not something that could only happen in Florida. It could happen everywhere, and does happen everywhere. You know, it's very common that when people make simchas parties nowadays, they bring in party planners. And you'll be careful to get a caterer with a very reliable hashgacha. You'll be careful to get a caterer who has a mashgiach there watching everything, and that the party planner has no supervision. And the party planner is bringing all sorts of food to this event. And when they bring all sorts of food to this event, they're bringing cake, so who knows where the cake was baked? And does it have hashgacha? And is it not milchig at a fleishig affair? And they're bringing vegetables, and everybody knows how complicated it is to check vegetables. There are many fruits and vegetables that we don't even allow to be used under any circumstances because they're just virtually impossible to clean and check. And who's supervising all of this? And this local Rav told us of an interesting, cute story. He says there was an affair here in Florida, a Shabbos affair, Friday night. And it's right before Shabbos, and the kitchen is busy. The mashgiach is in the kitchen making sure that everything is being done properly, getting ready for Shabbos. And in walks in someone with a stack of boxes, not sealed, not labeled, and puts them down. And the mashgiach turns around to this individual and says, "And who are you?" And the person says, "Well, I'm the party planner." "And what is this?" "This is cake." "And who baked this cake?" "I'm not telling you." "And who certifies this cake?" "I'm not answering to you." So the mashgiach says, "You don't have to answer to me, and you don't have to tell me, but this cake isn't going to be served, because this affair is under our hashgacha, and whatever is served here has to be under our supervision." The party planner obviously gets very agitated, and runs to the Baal Simcha, runs to the individual who's making the party, and tells this individual, look what's happening here. You hired me to do this event, to bring this food, and the Mashgiach is giving me a hard time. The individual goes into the kitchen, and the Mashgiach says, there's nothing to do. By now it's already Shabbos, and it's a very difficult situation. The Baal Simcha picks up the phone. Obviously he wasn't such an observant individual. Picks up the phone and calls the police. And he tells the police, calls 911. And they answer, yes. He says, we have a problem. He says, what's the problem? The cake has been kidnapped. The cake has been kidnapped. And the policeman says, is that an emergency? He says, absolutely. So it must be that here in Florida you don't have problems with crime. Although last night driving from the airport I saw there were many police on the road giving tickets, so I see they do have what to do. But obviously it was a quiet night, and they came over. And this is what was going on. It was actually good. The policeman should be in our field, because he came up with a great plan. He says, I respect the rabbi, and the rabbi says the cake can't be served indoor by the catering hall because the catering hall is all kosher. He's right. But there was a garden in the back. He says, why don't you set up the cakes and the other products that the party planner brought outside? That is in the area under your jurisdiction, and there, whatever people want to do, they can do. Ladies and gentlemen, you know, maybe he came up with a great suggestion, but that doesn't change the issue that I'm speaking about. The issue of people being careful and people thinking, and a consumer having a level of responsibility. It's not just enough that I make a simcha and I hire a caterer with a reliable hashgacha, and I make sure that that caterer brings proper, is under proper supervision. Everything has to be done properly. I just want to mention one more issue, and then we'll open the floor for questions, and then of course we'll give a chance to my distinguished colleague Rabbi Luban to speak. This year we know is a Shemitah year. Shemitah, the purpose of this lecture, maybe we'll get invited again, is not to speak about Shemitah, but there's a number of points that are very, very important that I would like to mention about Shemitah. We know whatever one holds about Shemitah and Eretz Yisrael, and whatever one's opinion is, certainly you need to be concerned about Shemitah. And you need to be concerned that the product that you're buying doesn't have a Shemitah issue. And therefore, one issue that is of very great importance, and it becomes more important this year than in other years, and that is there's produce that comes from Israel abroad. Particularly in the Shemitah year, where there's such a large population of Jews in Eretz Yisrael who are religious and don't want to have a problem with Shemitah and are very sensitive to Shemitah because they live in Israel and they know that this is something that they have to be thinking about all the time. So now you have these different farmers that have all of this produce that don't have their natural, normal, domestic consumer base. So what they'll do is they'll send those fruits and vegetables abroad. So it's very important that one check that the fruits and vegetables he's buying, it's important in all years, but particularly in all years there's the issue of Trumas and Maisris. This year, which can be rectified, Shemitah cannot be rectified. So one should be careful, if at all possible, to make sure that the fruits and vegetables they're buying are not from Eretz Yisrael. I was in Israel a couple of weeks ago. I had the opportunity to meet Rav Schlesinger, Rav Elio Schlesinger, who at that time, no longer, but at that time was the head of the Machleket HaKashrut in Rabbanut Yerushalayim, and he asked me to please come see him to tell me that this is something that really needs to be paid attention to and be publicized. One more very, very important issue. Israeli wine has become extremely popular. It's incredible to note that in a small country like Israel, there are 150 wineries. Not all of them have the OU yet. But there are 150 wineries. And again, in the Shemitah year, there's a real problem with the wine. And what happens is, for example, we, who certify quite a number of wineries in Eretz Yisrael, during the Shemitah year, we don't certify any wine. Because the wine that we certify is primarily for export, and you can't export Shemitah wine. But what happens, and this is something that the consumer has to be very careful with, you have a bottle of wine. You're very accustomed to drinking that wine. It has the OU on it, a reliable hexa that you always use. And now, you'll come into the store and you'll see that wine. And you won't pay attention to look for the kosher symbol. And that wine will not have the OU. It's not relevant yet. It's going to be relevant next year. It won't have the OU on it because it's Shemitah produce and doesn't have the OU. But you're used to always buying this wine with the OU on it. And not only that, what they do is they give it away for much cheaper because they got to get rid of it and they know that they have a problem that it doesn't have the OU Hashgacha and that it's a Shemitah product, so it can't be sold in Israel because people are careful. And even in Chutz La'aretz, many people are paying attention. You need to be very, so they're going to give it away for much less. And I've heard situations, the bottles of wine that could cost $30, $40 are sold for $10. And people go and they think they're getting a Metziah. There are no Metziahs because it's Shemitah product. In conclusion, I just want to repeat a vart that I saw not long ago for Ramey Shapiro. Ramey Shapiro says, the Pasuk says regarding Avram Avinu, Ki Yedatev. The Pasuk says, I love Avram Avinu Lemana Shiyitzava as Bonov Ves Beisoy Achrov. He teaches his family, his sons, Bisham Achrov following him, Bisham Mudarach Hashem. And Ramey Shapiro asked the question, why does the Pasuk have to say Achrov, that follow him? Of course, our children, our families follow us. So he says a tremendous point. I think it's relevant to today's talk. It's relevant to every time we have an experience of learning. When a father or a mother teach their child, when a teacher teaches their students, that moment is a fantastic moment. It's a moment where there's an ability to influence, there's ability to teach. But the strength of that moment is not in that moment alone. The strength in that moment is achrov, that the lesson that's learned remains with the child, and the lesson that's learned remains with the student, even when they're not with the teacher, even when they're not with the parent. And so too we come here for a short time to speak, but it's not much, there's much to say and not enough time to say it all. But we want to try to sensitize the audience, the consumer, as we spoke about earlier, to understand kashrus and to understand how complex kashrus is. And even though we live in a world, Baruch Hashem, as we discussed earlier, when you walk into the store, what isn't kosher? There's a lot that goes into making a product kosher, and there's a lot to think about before you buy a product, and the responsibility is not just the responsibility of the Rabbanim. Excellent question. Excellent question. Just to repeat the question. And the question is going to be better than the answer. I'm going to tell you that right away. The question that's being asked is that to put the OU on a label is no big deal. Any printer could put the OU on a label. And how do we at the OU know that every product that's out there with the OU is truly OU certified, or wasn't somebody just put the OU on the label? It's an excellent question. The answer is, there's a halachic answer to it, and there's a legal answer to it, and then there's a realistic answer to it. And I'll speak about all three of them. I myself asked this question many years ago to Rebbe Yoshev. I asked Rebbe Yoshev that the Gemara speaks, the Shulchan Aruch speaks about chaysamas, seals. So maybe, I asked him, in the times of Chazal, making a seal was something that was difficult. It was difficult to copy. But nowadays, as you just correctly mentioned, printing or putting an OU symbol on a product is very easy. So I asked him, what is the basis of us ever putting the OU on a label if it's so easy to do? So he turned around to me, very uncharacteristically, if you knew him, and he said, you need not be firmer than Chazal. You need not be more religious than Chazal. And if Chazal said that a siman is good, that's what's good. That's the first question, the first answer. That's the halachic answer. The legal answer, not that I'm a lawyer, is that a company, the OU is a trademark symbol owned by us. It's not only trademark in the United States, we have a trademark all around the world. If a company uses that symbol illegally, we will vigorously protect our symbol. And we have done so in many, many situations. And that creates a situation of mirsis. That creates a situation that somebody's going to be careful not to want to use our symbol fraudulently, because there's very serious legal repercussions. The third answer is the realistic answer. The realistic answer is that someone who does this always gets caught. Why? Because we live in a wonderful time, and we have wonderful consumers, and we have people in our office who spend their entire day just answering consumer calls. And I don't know, I may not be that way, but I don't go shopping either, but there are people who every time they go to the store and there's a product that's been OU certified forever and has the OU on the product, before they put it into the shopping cart, they'll either go online and look at our directory to make sure it's kosher certified, or call our office or email our office and ask, is this product really OU certified? Do you know that I asked, we have a rabbi, his name is Rabbi Nussbaum, who answers consumer calls. I asked him, what's the most popular question? He said the most popular question is, are Oreos dairy, because all Oreos have an OUD, or they're just dairy equipment? He says, about how many times a week do you get that question? He says, 300 times. Do you believe, if you multiply 300 by 50, that there are that many people asking the question? It's the same person asking. But every day, that person is nervous. Maybe today became dairy. Maybe today became dairy. And the point I'm trying to make to you is, the consumers, especially the sophisticated consumers that we live with now, are calling us with the questions, and therefore, if it's illegal, we're going to catch it. Yes? Okay, very good question. Also commonly asked question. The question was that the individual bought a product that's OU Pariv, but it has a disclaimer that it's made on equipment that has dairy. So my answer to you is, do you make Pariv products in your kitchen? Obviously. Do you make dairy products in your kitchen? Obviously. Because there's such very sensitive individuals, not just lactose intolerance, but there are individuals, and unfortunately it's a growing population, who have dairy allergies. And dairy allergies can actually be fatal. And there are individuals who are so sensitive to dairy that any speck of dairy can have a very, very serious consequence. And therefore factories, even though the product is perfectly Pariv, it's no different than anything you make in your kitchen, if you produce something in your kitchen, you would have to label it that way, because you have dairy in your kitchen and you have Pariv in your kitchen. But the prior product is 100% Pariv. That's why that disclaimer has no effect on the halachic status of the product.
What? I never.
The Oreo cookies. Oh, 301. The Oreo cookies. All of the regular Oreo cookies. Not are. They all have OUD.
Yes.
The reason they have OUD is because originally, when we began certifying Oreo cookies, they were indeed dairy. They stopped using any dairy in the regular Oreo cookies. So why don't they? But we don't have a DE designation at the OU, and that's why they're labeled OUD, but they're really just dairy equipment. And if you want an update, keep on calling the office. Yes.
Carvel's, Baskin Robbins, ice cream, like in parks and things like that. There's often a question of what you buy, what's kosher.
It's an excellent question. It's an excellent question. And we don't certify any of those types of shops. The OU, for many years, certified Häagen-Dazs. And for a while, they stopped, had Häagen-Dazs shops. I know in New York, maybe in other areas as well. And we never certified those establishments. Because even if the tub of ice cream we could be sure it's Häagen-Dazs, and you, the consumer, could also be sure it's Häagen-Dazs because it has Häagen-Dazs label all over it. The other products in the store, the sprinkles and the toppings, you know, these are products that need Hashgacha. Obviously, an ice cream shop is not going to agree to have a Mashgiach there full time. They're open on Shabbos, and we don't certify retail establishments that are open on Shabbos, so we've never certified it. But what we tell people is, if you go into the store and you see that they're taking out the ice cream from a tub, and you see that the scoop is clean, and you're not using any of the toppings, then you're okay. Yes.
How come?
Right. After rinse it off.
OUD pages I bought one week. Then I came back the second week, and the OU was not on it. On the OU products, the pages. Your company does not have the OU. I got one week, then when I came back the next week, I wanted another one. The OU was not on.
We're talking about OUP for Pesach or OU?
No.
Just for, in the same label, the same brand?
Yes, it's on the peaches. There was no label on the peaches. They come, you know, four and a half.
Right? I really don't know. I don't know the answer.
Yeah, I don't know.
You'll have to tell me the name of the brand. I can look into it.
Dole.
Can one have a cup of coffee on an airplane when you're pouring?
So airplane is much less of a problem. Good question. An airplane is much less of a problem. The reason an airplane is much less of a problem is, how do you have the urn on the airplane? The way you have the urn on the airplane is, you don't want it flying around. So they solder it into the wall of the kitchen. Since they solder it into the wall of the kitchen, then when they clean it, they don't disassemble it and put it into a dishwasher. They just clean it in place. They run through hot water and detergent, and since that urn is used only, so therefore the urn is much better. Now the question is, what we try to recommend is, if you can, you ask that they should give you in a paper cup coffee directly from the urn. That would be the best. Yes.
Can I ask a question about fish?
Sure.
For example, if you buy new girl, what is most expensive? You have to put it on
a grill. Right.
I know, I saw it a long time ago. Many places, for example, under the rule of you, even over here, the liver was sent and you put the skin on top. And I learned a little bit about fish too. This skin is a
sophic,
the
rice, the crumb. Right, the crumb.
The skin has to be removed.
The crumb.
So I ask a butcher once.
Right.
It's not a flag anymore. Why you don't remove the skin? He say, it's a good question. He say, if I remove the skin, the liver becomes sour. But I say to him, you have to move it because it's coming from the...
Yoyding Menachayluf.
Right,
Yoyding Menachayluf.
So that's suffering.
Right.
And he said, you're right, you have to be taken out. The same thing with the town.
As far as I know, a number of years ago, in fact, there was a major tumult about liver, and that was the issue. And we checked many livers, and we found that the krum, that is taken off, actually.
I wanted to answer a question about a year along the side.
Yeah. How many years ago?
I wanted to be one of the members there, but I didn't accept.
Right. Okay.
There's too many questions.
Okay. I don't want to take from Rabbi Luban. Yes. Very good question. More people are being makbid on Yashan. Actually, the OU is very, very involved in the area of Yashan, just to introduce the topic to people who may not know it. The Torah speaks about flour, and the Torah, grains, and the Torah tells us that anything that's harvested before Pesach, once Pesach comes, is considered Yashan and may be eaten. If it's only harvested after Pesach, you're going to have to wait for next year Pesach. That's called Chodosh. In Eretz Yisrael, everybody is makbid on Yashan. In Chutz Laretz, there are communities, actually more in the Chassidish communities, that are not makbid on Yashan. In the Yeshivish community, in the Brisker world, they're more makbid on this, and there are more and more people who are being careful about this. So quite a number of years ago, we were actually asked to attend the meeting. There was an individual who lives in Muncie, his name is Rabbi Herman, who for many years, where there wasn't a large group of people who were careful about Yashan, he was putting out a booklet with dates, how people could follow codes and dates and know. But he said now that he saw it has become so much more popular, he's turning it over to the OU. And the OU, as the organization that certifies almost all of the flour mills here in the country, General Mills, ConAgra, ADM, these are all the major players in the area of flour. We indeed have programs in place in every one of these flour mills to be able to determine what is Yashan and what is not, so that the factories and the consumers who want to buy Yashan product can know what is and what isn't. So the OU as an organization is not strict about Yashan. That means when you buy a baked product or you buy a pasta, we're not certifying that there's no Chodosh and Yashan issue. However, the OU is very involved in making sure that there's product, and there are some OU products that indeed say Yashan on them, and there's much flour that's being sold to bakeries and pizza shops that we're attesting and making sure that it's not a problem, so that those bakeries and pizza shops and other shops can be certified as not having an issue. Okay, I don't want to take away from Rabbi Luban's time.